advisor to NASA and Walter Cronkite during the manned space years of America. A man who has been a good friend to me and associate for years. A man who won the Engstrom Science Award. Richard C. Hoagland is here, and we have so much to talk about, we're just going to go ahead and launch right into it. Richard, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning. Richard, I don't know where to start. We have NASA news, but before I get to that, Richard, a second large iceberg has broken off the Antarctic and the Ross Ice Shelf. Let me read this to you, Reuters. A second giant iceberg has broken off from Antarctica and is bumping into a huge iceberg that broke off the Ross Ice Shelf last week. Matthew Lazara of the University of Wisconsin's Antarctic Meteorological Research Center found the latest iceberg, which will be named B-17, while scanning images taken from a satellite orbiting the poles. He said the new iceberg, check this, lies to the north and east of Roosevelt Island and is 80 miles by 12 miles. The larger iceberg that broke off the other day is 183 miles by 23 miles. And all of this visible from satellite. Something's going on down in the Antarctic.
Yeah, I'm looking at the same Reuters story. By the way, they compare the larger iceberg, thank goodness, to Jamaica. They stopped picking on Rhode Island, I guess, or Delaware.
Yeah,
it's hyperdimensional weather. I mean, I'm sitting here in the middle of a blizzard tonight. The high winds and storm you had yesterday?
Yes.
Well, you gently gave it to us tonight. And so it's 7,000 feet in front of a nice crackling fire. We've got snow whipping around. We have ice. We have winds above 50 miles an hour, according to the local weather forecast guys. And it's going to continue, they tell me, for the next couple of days. And, you know, tonight or tomorrow is April 1st, but I don't think this is an April Fool's joke. I think the weather is, in fact, changing. The climate is changing. And one of my authorities that I can cite is none other than Lee DeWitt, the head of FEMA?
I'm not sure.
Well, his last name is DeWitt. I forget his first name.
Okay.
He's been Clinton's head of FEMA, you know, ever since Clinton was elected. He sat on Fox the other day, about 20 minutes. They had a very elaborately produced piece with all kinds of background footage, B-roll, and he basically talked about major climate change. They're buying people out around the ocean fronts. They figure that it's cheaper for the feds to simply buy people's homes and never let anybody build there,
sure,
than to go in and give them loans to rebuild that never get repaid. So, I mean, there's a fundamental shift, both climatological and political, around this issue. And at the risk of beating an old dog, a friend of mine has a book that I recommend to people because it basically is a heads up on things are not going to continue the way they have been.
Well, Richard, it's obvious the weather is changing.
To some people, it's obvious.
Well, I mean, the chief U.S. Meteorologist along with the English meteorologist both said rapid climate change. And I'm not sure everybody was listening, but now more and more of the real mainstream guys are beginning to say, hey, wait a minute here, something else is happening.
Well, the key is in those ice cores. As you know, the Americans and the Soviets back the last 10 years drilled very deep holes, both in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, going down, I think, maybe a mile or something like that.
Right.
Several hundred thousand years, because you can basically take the cores from these deep holes up, slice them apart, and then do micro sections, thin sections, and measure year by year, like dating trees by means of their tree rings, the depths of snow and ice that have compacted down and down and down. And in the ice, there are little bubbles of air that are trapped, and those air bubbles contain the atmosphere samples from 10,000, 50,000, 200,000 years ago. So they have been looking at an enormous slice of climate, pun intended, for at least the last decade. And then the big surprise that you report in Global Superstorm is that the climate, as judged by those ice cores, by both Soviet and American researchers, appears to be able to shift on a dime and to go from balmy and sunny and summery to glacial in less than a year. And that may be the limit of the measurement because, of course, you have snow in certain seasons. So
sure,
it may even shift more rapidly, as you propose as a possible hypothesis in your book. The point is that what I'm intrigued with is why. And everybody thinks Al Gore, global warming, too many cars, too much CO2, et cetera, et cetera. But what the record is telling us is that before there was anybody here who could produce internal combustion engines,
it happened.
Something was going on.
You're
and
damn
you've
right.
got to take that data and say, wait a minute, are we up against a big set of cycles? And if we are, what drives them? That's the major question. What drives them? And then what can we do about it? How can we intelligently intervene?
Can we?
Well, I think...
There was also a big climate change on Mars.
Well, this is where, of course, John Brandenburg and Monica What's-Her-Name's book is so intriguing, because John, who was a member of our independent Mars investigation, the first Mars investigation I organized at SRI, lo, those many years ago, has a very interesting evolution in his consciousness and thinking on many fronts, not the least of which is he now sees Mars as the example of there but for something goes the Earth.
Sure.
And you did a very excellent interview with him the other night, and they laid out their case that Mars is the example. Mars is the, if you will, the prototype of what not to do. Now, I happen to think that a lot of weird stuff happened to Mars, a la Tom Van Flandern, and that Mars is not exactly the best example in the solar system because it's had some unique things occur that will never happen here. But the general perception of planetology, looking at the other planets of the solar system for lessons to be learned, we know there are grand cycles on Mars. If you look at the polar caps, if you look at Malin's latest stunning pictures, it's amazing how this guy can get pictures of everywhere but Cydonia. Look at his pictures of the comparison between the two polar caps of Mars, the North Pole and the South Pole, and you can almost count the rivets. You can almost count the individual little ice crystals in the Northern Pole ice cap of water. We know those poles are layered, like the layers of the poles of the Earth. And the presumption, going back to when Sagan was writing about this 30 years ago, is that those layerings in the polar caps of Mars have to do with seasonal and precessional and longer-term cycles. And in that case, going to the Martian poles would give us a handle on how nature forces planets into these periods where you really have a bad hair day, because it changes suddenly and not for the better.
Well, speaking of bad hair days and going to Mars, NASA has not had a lot of luck going to Mars.
That is an understatement.
Yeah.
As you said the other night, the closest they've come to Mars recently is in funding and backing, you know, Mission to Mars, that great bomb of film.
That's the closest, yeah. Anyway, the latest report, the official report from NASA, seems to suggest that the rockets that were fired were not fired at an appropriate moment or long enough, and that the spacecraft may have bashed itself into Mars. The one thing that I don't get is that it would have already discharged its two little friends by that time, or should have.
Yeah, and space probes 1 and 2.
Is that not correct?
That's correct. That
and
happened
so,
upstairs as it was approaching the atmosphere.
There you are. So not only did we fail with the main unit, but the other two are also dead as doornails. Now, what are the odds of that?
Well, I guess I'm jaundiced, but when I was listening to John Brandenburg the other night talk on your show about people at JPL telling him that they didn't really want to find anything because it would kind of upset the apple cart.
I figure you sat straight
well,
up in bed.
Well, it's nothing we don't know.
I mean, he came right out and flat said that a JPL employee, mid-level, came out and told him straight on, we don't want to find something big on Mars.
Well, when the SBSR group, the Society for Planetary SETI Research, you know, with McDaniel now and Carlotto and Brandenburg and DePietro and Horace Crater and, you know, a whole bunch of them, when they had their meeting at headquarters with Carl Pilker, and the so-called nod was given to take from the official side, from the management side, from high levels of NASA headquarters, the so-called three images.
Yes.
Before Malin said over my dead body, and then NASA had to kind of use some leverage and some money to grease the skids, and they didn't do that until we got all those faxes. So the politics of this are complicated. When they had that meeting, it was very clear that they felt that they were going to be in clover and that Cydonia research would then proceed apace. When it didn't, when after those three pictures, Malin said, never, ever again, and nobody ever saw anything decent from Cydonia, even on those three pictures, they felt they'd been snookered. But they've been looking, I believe, strongly, and we have some evidence tonight to back up, you know, this pretty major assertion, that they've been snookered because they think it's economics. They think it's simply a competition between JPL and Houston. JPL wanting unmanned probes, Houston wanting to go with men and women and guys and, you know,
But I'm not sure competition does any sort of justice to the allegation that Brennenberg laid down the other night.
It's more than that. It's a fig leaf. It's for people desperately trying to stay on the paper with some mainstream excuse when, in fact, they don't want to look at the real excuse, which is they don't want us to know, period. And, you know, the SBSR folks bought the economic excuse, and that's what Brandenburg was telling you, that JPL people were feeding him this, well, it's really all about competition and money and funding, and if Johnson got the money, we wouldn't get the money. Look, the lie to this excuse is the following. It's called history. When we were getting ready to go to the moon in a little project called Apollo, which I sat in on every single day because I was Walter Cronkite's right-hand guy for science and space science in those years, so I was paying attention, we had to proceed going to the moon with what? With robots.
Of course.
With unmanned probes. The scenario that Johnson, you know, the manned spacecraft center, could go to Mars without an enormous tripling or quadrupling or tenfold increase in JPL's budget for a flotilla of unmanned robots to make sure it was safe before the Martians
Let me ask you a question.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, but Richard, let me ask a question. Is it not technically easier to get a robot on the surface of the moon than it is to get one on the surface of Mars?
Now? No, not really.
Well, I mean, now you don't have so much atmosphere there at the moon.
But you had none at the moon.
That's what I mean. Yeah. But whereas in Mars, you have to deal with...
But atmosphere helps you. No. Remember, it's a lot tougher landing on an airless place where you got to use total rockets. When we send these probes, they aerobrake into the atmosphere, they use parachutes, and they use rockets basically to cushion the last few hundred feet. On the moon...
Yes, but aerobraking requires precise calculation.
Not really. It requires a pretty fast robot with an inertial guidance system, and basically the robot measures the pitches and rolls and yaws of your entering aeroshell, and then it steers it, just like the command module from Apollo was steered by the so-called S-turns and the energy dump maneuvers when the astronauts came back.
Yes.
Except they had to do it by hand with a little help from a very primitive computer. Remember, we've gone through an incredible computer revolution. We've got machines now that can almost think. They can certainly talk. And, you know, JPL is at the front edge of that technology, not the back end. The stuff you can buy in Radio Shack is trivial compared to the stuff that the government, the DOD, the military, the Pentagon, JPL, NASA, the CIA, the NSA, all those folks have access to. So you mean to tell me that we can't do it? No, of course we can. So all of this strange stuff that's happened, frankly, I think is horsepucky. And I think this whole young report and what happened to Mars Climate Orbiter and Mars Polar Lander is a bit of a cover story. And I have some proof, which past the end of the hour, we're going to talk about the politics we have learned. And the person we learned them from is no less prestigious and authoritative. And, you know, the final say on this than the administrator of NASA himself, Mr. Daniel Golden.
Well, you know, Richard, I've listened and I have not fully embraced, but I am coming to a threshold of belief with regard to this, which is going to be in agreement with you for a whole lot of reasons. Brandenburg, I thought, made an awful lot of good points the other night about the face and about even the poor photographs integrated with the old face photographs. Total up to a story that, as Tom Van Flanderen has said, it's got to be billions to one, that it's not an artificial object.
Well, remember, we have the work of the SBSR team, we have the work of our guys, we have independent experts like Tom Van Flanderen, we have Kinthea, remember, our artist who's worked for 15 years on this and who carefully compared the two data sets with their own models and the computer modeling and all that. We have an enormous body of evidence that says they're hiding the most extraordinary discovery in the history of mankind, and now we've got a film by Brian De Palma.
We've got the mystery of the film.
Well, the mystery is you got a guy who's a major, major player in the film industry, produces a blockbuster film that, you know, takes number one the first week out, And the night that it goes and premieres, he disappears to France.
Yeah.
And gives one little dinky interview over the internet to some fan site, which is linked to Enterprise, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think I have figured out what De Palma's trip was, and I'm writing a review, which we'll post in the next few days, and people can read it, and then they can all attack me like they usually do.
Yeah.
But the point is that there are converging threads here. And the converging threads are there's been this major contretemps between JPL, which has kind of thought it owned Mars, and headquarters and Johnson, and people have been fed information that, well, it's real, but it's all about money. And tonight we have new news, folks, because it turns out it's not about money. It's about what we all have thought has been going on for the last 50 years.
And for that information, they'll all have to hold on, because we approacheth the bottom of the hour. Richard C. Hoagland is my guest, and what he's about to tell you, I think, may confirm everything you suspected as you listened all this time might be true. We'll be right back. Admit, I'm a little naive. I grew up with a kind of a Boy Scout mentality when it came to our agencies like the FBI, even the CIA. I can't say that for the NSA. Certainly NASA. You know, it was all American and above board and everything. But if you're known by the company you keep, then what might we know about the leader of NASA, Daniel S. Golden, and the company he keeps, Richard?
Well, let's set the stage here, because this is not happening in a vacuum, pun intended. I think that this has been set up for us to eavesdrop and peer into the inner sanctum, and I don't know quite how it was arranged, but it certainly looks like it was arranged from several on-the-record statements made by several of the players. This all started, as you know, last fall, when en route to Mars with Mars Climate Orbiter, suddenly the agency mixed up metric units and English units, and plunk, a $125 million spacecraft went splat in the atmosphere of Mars.
Cheaper, faster, flatter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, we in this culture are very curious. I mean, here we have the prospect, based on a lot of us independent guys' research for like a generation, 20 years, that there's an ancient set of ruins on Mars waiting to be discovered by the mainstream, with untold potential for humanity if and when this occurs.
Absolutely.
And nobody gives a damn.
I do.
I mean, really, except for the people who listen to this show.
Well, that's a lot of people.
Well, but they're not the majority of the 260 million Americans.
Listen to me, Richard. I think a lot of them are kind of like I have been, and that is naive and a little Boy Scoutish when it comes to their beliefs about NASA.
And the question is, if this was really true, Dick, how could it be kept so secret? Everybody would know, which is the biggest ruse in the world, because there are all kinds of major things that have been kept secret for decades, centuries.
It's true.
Generations.
True.
Okay, so then you've got other stuff that we found. On the moon, you know, you talked with Ingo last night. You got stuff on the moons of Jupiter. The whole damn solar system has got stuff.
I want to ask you about the moon because of what Ingo said last night, but I don't want to get sidetracked. Let's finish
up. We will pursue. I'm just setting the stage here, because then, after the Mars Climate Orbiter disappeared, you had this major hiccup. Oh, my God. They wasted some money. You know, that's the only thing that counts, right? They wasted some money. So let's make sure we don't do it on the next one, which is following on the heels, Mars Polar Lander. So they did all kinds of reviews and studies and the kind of things you think NASA does wonderfully. And plop, the spacecraft goes to Mars and disappears.
Mm.
Not a peep. Not a word.
Peep. Not a peep.
Now, we've got two missions, total price about $365 million, which is not even chump change in the arenas where billions of dollars here and billions of dollars there, and pretty soon it adds up to real money, as some senator once said. And now you've got major investigations. You've got the Stevens Commission, and you've got the Young report going to be filed. And then a few days ago, we get this UPI story out of all people, James Oberg, the mouthpiece for Houston, for manned missions, for the Soviet space program, you know, the world's best expert on the Soviets and what they did or did not do in space.
Yeah.
The person who has been absolutely in NASA's corner 1,000%, and tells all of us out here, me included, you know, you're all crazy, there's nothing going on, you're just seeing things, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly, Oberg writes, for a major wire service, a story attacking NASA for not only knowing that there was a problem with the Mars Polar Lander before it got to Mars, but covering it up.
Yeah, very serious charge. And, of course, from Oberg, who had been such a defender of NASA, to be saying that, it's just astounding. So, y'all, any reasonable person out there listening right now has got to factor what you just heard in. How could he write such a story? How could there be such a big turnaround from Oberg? How?
And it still has not been explained. Because what Golden the next day, the head of NASA, in front of Senate committees, which we'll get to in a second, said was, are you out of your mind? I put my reputation. I would never cover anything up. We put everything on the record. We have press conferences here. We laid out the test results there, et cetera, et cetera. Neglecting to address a key point in Oberg's accusation, which was not that they didn't lay out the engine problems, the braking rockets. When you get to Mars, you got to slow down.
Right.
Which are separate from the braking rockets when you're just a few hundred feet above the surface. There are two different sets of braking rockets that we're going to discuss here. The first set, are you moving along at thousands of miles per hour, and you got to slow down, otherwise you'll smack into the atmosphere of Mars, like Mars Climate Orbiter, and splat.
Right.
Your history,
flat.
So you got to slow down.
Yep.
Oberg's claim was that the testing of those engines not only was bad, but that the test conditions had been changed so that they ultimately could pass the altered test, and NASA covered that up.
And NASA knew the mission would fail and covered
because
it up. That's
that,
what Oberg charged
that's what
in the story.
And that was never addressed by any of the ultimate responses by NASA. In fact, when UPI, during one of his hearings, Golden said, sat there at the table and said, well, you know, you're really nice if UPI had called me to get our response before they published this irresponsible thing. Well, after the fact, they have tried repeatedly, I understand, to reach Golden for comment on the ensuing details of the unfolding story, and NASA has refused to return the calls of UPI.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, and this is on the record. I've got tons of printouts from the Internet. I mean, without the Internet, you can't do this. So last night, I'm up very late searching because of the grace of the one day. Peter's news coming and us switching and all that.
Yes,
gave me an extra day
yes.
to unearth what I think is the earthquake here, boys and girls. The thing that pulls all these threads in this unraveling quilt together. Because in the middle of the night, I discovered the speech by Dan Golden a couple of days ago at JPL, pursuant to the issuance on Tuesday of this week of the Thomas Young Report. Now, Thomas Young, I actually knew Tom Young back when he was one of the high-level managers of the Viking program back during when we went to Mars in 1976. Tom was working for NASA. He then moved laterally to work for Martin Marietta, which eventually became Lockheed Martin and became a high executive there for many, many years. He is now in retirement, and they called him out as an expert, kind of an independent expert, to oversee a team of 18 people to debrief everybody at JPL and the contractors and Lockheed Martin to figure out what the hell went wrong with Mars Polar Lander. And after weeks of this, you know, from December to March, on Tuesday of this week, he issued his report, and everybody covered it. CNN covered it, CBS covered it, Fox, et cetera.
Right.
And it's all over the Internet. Well, 2 days afterwards, Dan Golden, the head of NASA, tiptoes out on an airplane to JPL to basically brief his guys out there, who, of course, took the brunt of the criticism of the Young Report.
Sure.
The Young Report basically says, and you can find this all over the web, that, you know, they skimp too much. You know, Sam, you made the pants not too long, but too short. And they had too few managers, and they let all kinds of things go by that in the good old days they didn't. And for want of, you know, a nail, the shoe and the spacecraft and the mission and the country was lost, and isn't that terrible? So Golden goes to JPL to basically lay out for his guys a pep talk and say, well, you know, you're the best and the brightest, and you're unique, and we need you, and you're going to help us fix this, and we'll go on to greater glory and greater heights. And frankly, it's only $500 million, and so why should we?
Only $500 million.
That's what he said.
And so the title of the talk he gave was When the Best Must Do Even Better.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
So at JPL, March 29th.
Yep, which was a couple days ago.
Okay.
So I'm in this 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm pulling this down, and I'm trying to get my ducks in line to do this, you know, reasonable report tonight on where we are with all of this strange stuff.
Sure.
And suddenly, and I gotta you know, give some praise here to Steve Bassett, our UFO lobbyist in Washington.
Yes.
Steve called me earlier tonight and had found the same document, and he went into orbit just like I did. He knew instantly exactly what this meant.
Well, I think a lot of my audience will. And you want to do it, or shall I do it?
Well, let me do it, because I want to do a setup. I want to, you know.
Well, we have only so much time.
I understand.
We had better get set soon.
I will move quickly here.
All right. This is important.
This is not linear, folks. You know, everybody expects it to just kind of lay out on the floor, and you just can kind of hear what people say, and it's there.
Yes.
In this game, it's, as you said last night, you love reading between the lines. I was astonished to hear you say that, my friend.
Oh, well, I do.
Because many times I lay out lines, and you don't read. But here, you are easily on the same page, because this is what Dan Golden said to the troops at JPL 2 days ago. He first of all thanked the head of Caltech, David Baltimore, a Nobel Prize laureate in medicine.
Right.
He says, actually, David canceled plans to be here today. I think it's just a small expression of his strong support of the people here and the work they do. Thank you, David. Then he said in this paragraph...
Listen closely. This is a key paragraph, folks.
He did not have to say this.
I know. Go ahead.
This is the key thing. Dan Golden is telling everybody, everyone listening right now, Dan Golden is talking to you to tell you what's really been going on in the following sentences. He said, and I quote, "I'd also like to acknowledge Admiral Inman, head of the JPL Oversight Committee at Caltech."
Now, okay.
He couldn't be here today, but I talked to him by phone. His commitment to the team here is also unwavering, and I thank him for that. And every bell and whistle and fireworks went off, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, holy...
I'm sure you did. Now, for anybody who might not know who Admiral Inman is, Richard?
Well, he was the former head of the National Security Agency. He's been involved in naval intelligence and the CIA. Clinton tried to make him head of, I believe, the CIA at some point in the past. He's been the key guy involved in every single intelligence operation of this government for the last 30 or 40 years. And he's also been heavily involved in the UFO controversy. In other words, here is Mr. Black Project himself, who is head of an oversight committee at Caltech, whose job it is to make sure JPL does not stray from the party line.
Admiral Inman, JPL, NASA Administrator Golden. Oh, and it's in the second paragraph of his speech.
Which is a message to all of us.
It's a clear message.
Crystal clear message.
For anybody who thought that there might not be any darkness, any dark programs, anything we really might not know, because they tell us everything, would Admiral Inman, in the opinion of most of you out there, be the kind of guy who would tell us everything? He's oversight, for God's sakes, for JPL. So, y'all think about this real hard, because I have, and I think a reasonable person, with all of this beginning to get laid out on them, has got to say, only thing we can do, we know there's two more passes coming up where they can get real photographs of the face, the way we knew it and loved it, at about the same angle, and so forth and so on, we must petition Dan Golden and anybody else we can think of who will have influence to get the damn pictures taken.
Well, here is the MacGuffin. We have been trying to get other people to look at this problem for now several years. In the last few weeks, we've been focusing on one Senator John McCain. Let me quote to you what John McCain said in response to the Young Report a couple days ago. He says, "My initial review of the Young Report on Mars Polar Lander and Deep Space Two missions confirm my belief that NASA senior management is missing in action. This report is an embarrassment to the agency. I believe it's important that this committee exercises more rigorous oversight of NASA from this point forward." Now, here's the marching orders, troops, okay? If you want to change this, you need to do two things. You need to fax John McCain at 202-228-2862. That's 202-228-2862, and Art will give this out at the end of our segment.
Right.
And tell him you want this to stop. Tell him that the jig is up, that there's tremendous ice under the tip of this iceberg. It's not just about money. It's about stealing the American space program from the American people under the guise of national security and people whose job it is to keep us from knowing.
And
we now have the smoking gun.
And Golden.
And Golden. Of course, Golden spent 30 years in the Black Project. he is the guy who I think is trying to be a good guy here. He's trying to send the message, hey, folks, it's not me, it's him, it's them, it's the intelligence agency.
Whatever the message, it's
the only reason he would put that in that speech is to tell the rest of us what the game has really been.
His fax number.
His fax number is 202-358-2810. That's 202-358-2810. Now, I have another request. We got a guy in Washington, Steve Bassett, who is poised to go over and talk to McCain's people. In your faxes, tell him that he is your designated hitter. That if they want a briefing on everything, the whole UFO, ET, ruins, NASA involvement here, the ice below the tip of the iceberg, have a sit-down meeting with Steve Bassett on behalf of Enterprise Mission, on behalf of ART, and behalf of basically yourselves.
By the way, Richard, last night with Ingo Swann, I asked him specifically about the moon. And he said, there's stuff there. And he said, and them. He said, stuff and them. And again, when I heard that and he said it so calmly and assuredly, I thought, boy, Richard Hoagland told us about that an awful long time ago.
Yeah, we got the photographs to prove it. Look, you've got the STS-80 videos, you've got the STS-48 videos, you've got a whole bunch, 2,800 hours of new videos that no one's had time to go through. You've got photographs from Apollo, photographs from Lunar Orbiter, photographs from Viking, photographs from Pathfinder. There's an enormous body of evidence, but obviously this political process is broken. And to rectify it, you need a guy. I mean, McCain has now been stepping up to the plate, and I've been getting these faxes coming in. The faxes are working. The inside word in Washington is McCain is paying attention to NASA because you out there in the country do give a damn, and you've been letting him know, and you simply need to turn up the heat. You need to let him know loud and clear that he can be the guy on the white horse to bring sanity to this insane situation where you pay the money and they get to call the tune.
Well, very quickly, what are the next two available dates for good imaging of Cydonia, or at least the next one? Do you know?
The computer says that June 17th is our next pass over
Cydonia. Hey, that's
Cydonia.
My birthday.
Really?
Yeah, June 17th. I'll be 55 and entitled to discounts in some places.
Oh, well, I passed that threshold slightly before you do, okay? Anyway, June 17th and then September 13th. And this comes from our celestial mechanics expert, Dr. Thomas Van Flandern, so you can take that to the bank.
All right. Then, Richard, let me give out the numbers. Let me say thank you for being here and stirring the pot wonderfully for us. And I will give out these numbers again and make damn sure we get the faxes out, all right?
Excellent. Excellent.
Good night, my friend.
You too, Art.
All right. Listen, take this down, folks. Senator McCain, fax number, public. Area code 202-228-2862. Dan Golden, the administrator of NASA. Area code 202-358-2810. That's 202-358-2810. And I'd like to remind you, those are public fax machines. You are the public. And a reasonable person who had listened to what's going on tonight, in my opinion, would be on their fax machine very quickly indeed. All right, we're going to break here at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back. How much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Don't touch that dial.
Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. AM 840, KXNT.
Attention, investors.
take a ride? Well, call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
Well, it's Rod time. Good morning, everybody. I am Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Coming up toward the bottom of the hour is Major Ed Daines, following on the heels of an incredible interview last night with the master himself. But in a moment, I've got an announcement coming up for you that, frankly, has been much too long in coming. Should have been made a long time ago. Couldn't do it, though. And I'll tell you all about it in a moment.
Say the words you want to hear.
Attention, employer.
AM 1500, KSTP.
Well, all right, for the past year, there has been an unsatisfactory situation with regard to my ability to do the program. And as you know, I have been doing the best I can and have been doing about 3 days a week for about the past year. And many of you have asked many questions that I've been unable to respond to. And in a moment, I hope you're going to understand why I've been unable to respond to them. But I have a statement that I'm going to read for you that I hope will clear up a lot of things. Not an easy statement, and I'll kind of follow it up with some additional information. But I guess there's no other way to do it other than to just do it. So if you would listen very closely, I think this will explain a lot for you. Here we go. In order that you all understand the gravity of the announcement I'm about to make, it's going to be necessary for me to repeat some very painful events that have occurred to my family over the past several years. On May 16th of the year 1997, my son, Art Bell IV, was kidnapped, transported across state lines, and raped by a substitute teacher from his own high school. The assailant was HIV positive. My son was a minor. He was only 16 years old at the time. The teacher involved was tried, convicted, and is now serving a life sentence. My son, though, as you might imagine, was sent into a psychological tailspin which continues to this very day. We're trying very, very hard to help him recover and lead a more normal life. Some positive events have occurred toward that end, and your prayers are welcome. Please keep them coming. While the police work and the trial of my son's assailant were underway, difficult as it was for me to continue my daily radio programs, I did so. Because my son was a minor at the time of the crime, the records were sealed. His name was not made public, something our society does to protect its own, its future, its young people. As our family was working through this trauma in private, an event beyond all bounds of decency and humanity occurred. On December 9th of 1997, just a few months after my son's ordeal, my own began. Ted Gunderson, a retired FBI agent, along with David Hinkson and the assistance of others, aired a broadcast which incredibly, absolutely incredibly, accused me of committing the very same crime my son had suffered, child molestation. The program further stated that I had paid to cover up an indictment in Nye County, Nevada, my home. It further urged listeners to call me on air and ask if I had been indicted. Of course, these accusations were entirely false, but nevertheless, the calls poured into my open-line, unscreened program asking if this was true. I had no choice but to block out all these calls and keep my silence for fear of my son's situation becoming public. This broadcast was made on WWCR, Worldwide Shortwave Radio in Nashville, Tennessee. The station has been described by newspapers and civic-minded organizations as one of the country's leading broadcasters of hate radio. the individuals, WWCR and its sister station, WNQM, have allowed to broadcast over the airwaves include a man who wrote a book entitled The Hitler We Loved and Why, and another man who stated over the airwaves that Jews are the children of Satan and that African Americans are mud people. In addition to broadcasting these proponents of hate and violence, this radio station has consciously decided not to spend money on a delay switch, not to conduct a careful background check of the people it places on the air, and to allow individuals to say almost anything they want in foreign languages without having staff on duty who can even understand what they're saying. In my opinion, WWCR is one of the most irresponsible stations permitted to broadcast over the airwaves of this country. Now, the fallout from that broadcast has been unbelievable. Besides the unrelenting accusatory calls, others repeated this false rumor as though it was fact, resulting in several related lawsuits. Many of you may have heard my defense played out on the airwaves and the internet. No matter how hard I've tried to set the record straight, my torment and that of my family continues. Recently, a radio host in Toronto, Canada, opened his morning show with the words, "I'm Art Bell, and I molest little children." All of this sent me into a psychological tailspin. I felt I'd been dealt a blow I might not recover from. Still, I continued my nightly broadcast as best I could. In October of 1998, my son came to a crisis point, a situation so critical that nothing but my full-time attention would help. So on that fateful day, October 13th of 1998, I resigned on air with no intention of returning. But thanks to the efforts of my network, my best friend Alan Corbeth, Craig Kitchen, CEO of Premier Networks, and Randy Michaels, I was able to return. But the pressure of having to defend myself against baseless, vile claims that I was a child molester eventually forced me to reduce my on-air hours. Why the individuals behind the December 9th, 1997 broadcast by WWCR decided to make such a patently false and harmful broadcast remains for the courts to decide. A major moment in this litigation is going to occur April 28th in Nashville, Tennessee. If justice prevails, a trial, perhaps a protracted one, may follow. It would be untrue for me to say this has not affected my air work. It has. It would be unfair to all of you not to give you my full-time best, and I can no longer do that. The reality that after suffering the fate of my son's own molestation, I now stand destined to be tainted for life as a child molester has proven simply too much to bear. God knows I have tried. For my son, I pray that somehow his wounds will heal, his mind's troubles fade into something of a normal life. For myself, an ordeal looms ahead to clear my good name of accusations. I committed a crime committed against my own son. Nobody ever said life would be fair, only to be lived as the hand is dealt to you. For all the years of joy my work has provided, I want to thank all of you and whatever creative force allowed it. I have decided to retire from the broadcast business at the end of this month. My last show to be April 26, 2000. I will not do any media interviews on this subject. I've already said more than any private person would have said. A private world I now look forward to returning to. Any further questions should be addressed to my attorney, Gerard Fox, at the law firm of Fox, Sigler & Spillane in Los Angeles at area code 310-229-9300. That's Fox, Sigler, and Spillane in Los Angeles at area code 310-229-9300. Well, there you have it. That's the announcement as such, and I'm glad to be able to level with you now and tell you why I am doing what I am doing and what I have been going through. It has been very, very, very hard for me not to answer the emails. Not to answer the people who said, "Why, you lazy bum, get back to work." I can play you those. So I hope, in to some degree, that helps you to understand what has been going on during this period of time. Now, I want to give you some assurances that I think will make you feel a little bit better. Number one, Coast to Coast AM will continue. This program, in its current form, in the, will continue, in other words, the same genre will continue. It will continue to be a program devoted to what is it that we have done here? The strange, the unusual, the bizarre. It will continue in that vein. I can assure you of that. And I've got another announcement. Not only will it continue, but instead of five live days per week, Coast to Coast AM, beginning with my retirement, will begin to be live 7 days a week. That's right, 7 days a week live. Can you imagine that? In addition, I would like to announce that within, about 2 weeks, our network, my network, Premier Radio Networks, will announce the successor to this program. I don't know, the heir apparent, the successor, whatever you want to call the person who's going to come in here and do all these strange things that I have done over these years. Perhaps not in the same way. Perhaps with a bit of a different edge to his personality or her. But be assured, it will not only continue, but it will get bigger. Something that I really want for the program more than anything else. As you know, I love this program in a very deep, abiding way. I love what we do here, and I want to assure you that will not change. Now, I want to clear a couple of things up. Earlier in the evening, the news began to break on the Drudge Report. Matt Drudge reported, I can read it. It says, late night talk radio sensation Art Bell is set to leave radio. The Drudge Report has learned. According to sources, Bell will announce his resignation tonight, Friday, and will officially leave the air next Wednesday. Wrong. The actual date is Wednesday, April 26th. Matt? It goes on to say the announcement is bound to throw the radio industry upside down. Oh, I don't know about that. Bell is heard in over 400 markets. Family concerns have convinced Bell to leave radio. Premier is considering Ian Punnett of Atlanta as a replacement host to Bell, according to insiders. Well, that's only partially correct. Ian is certainly being considered with others. And is definitely a contender for the a position, but not necessarily the named heir apparent. As I told you, that'll be about 2 weeks from now when we announce that. He goes on to say the announcement to be made on April Fool's Day, East Coast time, is bound to raise questions. Do you have questions? Last year, Bell left the airwaves, vowing never to return, only to return several months later. It was later revealed that Bell's son was sexually assaulted by a school teacher that was carrying HIV. Art Bell is not replaceable, declared one program director in a major market. If this report is correct, we have lost a great talent. Now, thank you, Phil. That was nice of you to say. He's going to announce his intentions during the second hour of his broadcast, said a well-placed source. You always have to wonder who these well-placed sources are. At least sometimes you wonder about that. So, again, I want to thank everybody concerned. My very best friend, Alan Corbett, and mentor, Alan and I have been together many years now. And, of course, Premier Radio, Craig Kitchen, has been wonderful to me throughout all of this. So much that has been going on that you simply don't know about. And I have, and my family has, a very great deal that looms in front of it. So, I guess that's it. That's the announcement. As it is, I am going to retire, and it is going to be a permanent retirement. I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss you. But I feel that I'm doing what I must do to tend to the business I must tend to that would take me only further away from the program if I tried to remain. And I would not be serving you with the kind of service that over the years you have come to expect from me. I simply want to assure you that the forum, my friend, is going to continue. And that is more important than any single person. And much as it not, might be nice for somebody to say that of me, that I'm irreplaceable, I am not. Everybody is replaceable. What would be an irreplaceable loss would be the format, the forum, that I have cherished so long. That will not be lost. As a matter of fact, it will be strengthened. So, tell the world, yes, I may be retiring, but Coast to Coast AM and its ways will continue unabated. All right, coming up in a moment, we're going to, and by the way, I really don't want to get a lot of calls on this. I realize a lot of you are going to want to call about this subject, but I have made my decision for the reasons I have stated. But by the way, if you didn't hear the whole thing, oh, yes, you need to check my website. There is the statement I just gave in written form, soon in audio form, as well as a press release from Premier Radio Networks. So all of that is up there, and I think you'll note the website has a slight different look to it. That said, coming up shortly from Hawaii, Major Ed Dames.
The hint that she leads you to. These days, says, I feel my life just like a river running through the air of the cat. Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
And to finish up, a very good ride it has been. Good morning, everybody. Around the corner, the man they call Dr. Doom. As a matter of fact, earlier today when he called me, he said, "Hi, Art, Dr. Doom, my answering machine." yet another remote viewer. To follow up last night's, I think, incredible interview with Ingo Swann. It should be quite a night tonight. SciTech's Major Ed Dames coming right up. Last night, we had Ingo Swann here. Ingo Swann is regarded by many, we'll ask Ed, many as, you know, the father of remote viewing. He objected a little to that and said, well, with Hal Putoff, okay. But Ingo really began it. He told us some incredible things last night about remote viewing. Remarkable man. Absolutely remarkable. And I'm honored to have been able to interview him prior to leaving the radio. Through the years, I have been interviewing Major Ed Dames, who is also a remote viewer, was part of the military remote viewing program. There are some who doubt that. I don't. I have a full copy of his a military service record, and I know exactly what he did. as much as they would put in there, at any rate, certainly confirming he was absolutely an integral part of that project, the whole remote viewing project that was revealed one night on Nightline in kind of a wild way and shocked the nation. And then, of course, from that sprang eventually SciTech, the company that he formed privately. And now he's moving even beyond that in some ways. He's major at Dames. They nicknamed him Dr. Doom for good reason. A lot of what he saw, or what he chose to see, and we'll talk a little bit about that, I guess, a kind of weighed in on the negative side, frankly, to be honest with you. And some of what you're going to hear tonight is going to be on the negative side, some on the positive. But there is going to be some environmental news that is going to be very, very disturbing. So let me issue my normal, hey, you better be careful who's listening to this kind of statement. If this sort of thing bothers you, dire news, or what seems to be dire news, or you have children around, then send them to bed. They need not hear this. Some of it is pretty rough stuff, and you can already see a lot of it coming. I'm sorry to say. What he talked about 2 years ago has already, to a great degree, manifested itself. He is Major Ed Dames, and here he is from Hawaii, ensconced in paradise. Ed, how you doing?
I'm skating away on the thin ice of a new day. Along
yeah.
with you.
Aren't we all? Yes.
And Jessel Tull.
Yes, yes. Did you hear the interview last night with Ingo?
I heard most of it, yes.
Good. He's a remarkable man, isn't he?
He is indeed. And despite his humbleness, he is the father of remote viewing.
It was hard for me to understand, Ed, how such a great natural like Ingo Swann was used to come up with what eventually became these very strict protocols that were used in the military. He explained it, but I still didn't fully understand it. Maybe you can tell me how that happened.
It is a long story, but I can try to make it a short one. Ingo was one of the few great naturals in this country in this era. He mentioned a few others. Hella Hammond, Harold Sherman were two others that were very good. Pat
sure.
Price was the first one that were utilized as a baseline by the intelligence community to see if we could utilize their talents to gain access to programs that were very classified in other countries.
Sure.
Ingo was the only lab rat, however, that studied himself. Well, since he had experiences as an 18-year-old in Telluride, Colorado, where he grew up before he moved to New York City, he was introspective. He looked at the way he recognized his abilities and determined to try to discern how he was acquiring this information. And this is very, very important, because in the end, Hal Puthoff, after years of research in the laboratory, turned to Ingo, and this was they were desperate at this time because they were ready to lose a U.S. Army grant at the time, a very lucrative grant. They had to come up with results, and the results in this case, the replication was there. Ingo Swann was able to replicate, to deliver the goods, that is, to accurately remote view targets over and over again using these controlled protocols that were set up. Geographic coordinates were used at the time to bring off a few targets.
But so, I still don't quite get it.
There wasn't a model, Art. There wasn't a way that Ingo could describe how he was doing it, nor could
exactly
Hal Puthoff do that. And finally, Hal turned to the guinea pig himself and said, can you explain how this is done? And so it was actually Ingo Swann who laid out the steps, the cookbook, if you will, the recipe for how he was acquiring this data. And that was the brainstorm. This was a complete stroke of brilliance, because not only was it correct, but in laying it out and assuming that this is an innate ability in man, what we had now was a model and with a model for how Ingo himself, the great natural psychic of the 21st century, was able to do this, the model could be used to teach others who, like me, were about as psychic as a rock. And what this resulted in was a consistency, and this is the key term, a consistent performance over and over again, enough so that we could be used to support military operations, even in life or death circumstances. That was the breakthrough. And that is when I said, thank you very much, Ingo, and I took this into the deep, dark, black world of intelligence. And it went from there.
Well, I just heard all that, but I'm still... I guess I crave details that probably can't be related, but how Ingo puts into words something that is should be indescribable, because you don't know how the hell it happened. So,
that's not
how do you
true.
Translate that to an eventual manual with real tight protocols telling people like you, who are psychic as a rock, how to begin to train yourself to do... And innately, you see where I'm going here?
This, of course, is what my company has done for a living for 10 years. Is that we train people to do this in very evolved ways, but very strict, rigorous protocols. It's like language, Art. The way that I have ideas that I wish to express to you, for instance, right now. And although at the preconscious level I'm selecting words to use to speak with you.
Yes.
And those that is that they're being drawn from my lexicon, my vocabulary, my thesaurus, my memory banks. There is some preconscious process that's doing this, and it's autonomic. It's automatic. It's happening by itself. Having said that, however, I still have to structure my sentences, the concatenation of subject, verb, object, to effectively communicate these ideas that are loose and fuzzy to you. In something that is meaningful. Well, the same kind of structure is what Ingo discovered. The way, and it's a very, it is a standardized way that for all of us as human beings, the way that our unconscious mind communicates data accurately when it does to conscious awareness. And Ingo was able to follow, to slow down this train and say, okay, first comes this, next comes this class of information, then this. It goes from the general fuzzy idea, which you call the Gestalt,
right,
to the general idea about a target being a person, place, thing, or event, to detailed specifications, detailed specific things about the target, and finally sketches and drawings. And the way that this is done was the way that was laid out in this model that in those days was called coordinate remote viewing.
How was it decided, Ed, how the target would be assigned? Because that was a big difference from what Ingo did. He searched or assigned his own targets. That is not what's done in technical remote viewing.
In those days, somebody just picked the target and wrote it down. Pat Price was the same way. They wrote the name of the target down, and mind was able to pick this up and to actually turn its unconscious attention to this target, and conscious awareness would describe it. What the military needed was something a whole lot more systematic than that.
Right,
what we
sure.
essentially was the same thing we did for missiles and bombs. I wanted to send a missile to Red Square. I would use the, you know, 8-digit coordinates for where I wanted this nose cone to drop down, right? Well, we started using the same thing both as a control and as an operational modality, Cartesian coordinates, latitude and longitude. What is at this specific latitude and longitude? And this is how it started in terms of the systematic target description. What is here? Then Ingo found that he could not only describe the exterior of a site, let's say in the middle of a forest there was a Soviet missile launcher, a transporter erector launcher.
Mm-hmm.
He could describe that. But when he was given coordinates for building, he was able to find that he could just as easily move inside of the building as well as describe the exterior, too. And that's how all this started. These are rudimentary now. We've come a long way. Ingo used to wax rose at me when I called him the Wright Brothers of remote viewing. In fact, that's what he is. He's the one. Without him, there would be no flight. Allegorically.
I did see a very gracious letter that you sent that Ingo wrote to you when you launched the private SciTech effort.
In 1989, I took all of the best and the brightest military remote viewers. I took them because they were, as many of your listeners know, the program was falling apart from the inside. So in order to preserve all of the professionalism and the discipline itself, since the government was about to abandon it, I took the viewers and formed SciTech. And over the years evolved coordinate remote viewing into technical remote viewing. And this
how different is it, coordinate from technical? How many changes, how much did you really morph the whole thing?
There are two very important changes in terms of the structure. The structure is extremely tight and very tight now, far tighter than it was in the days when we used it in the military. And what this does is it acts as a double check to make sure our minds do not slip off of the given target. The targets are assigned in training as unconsciously. Random numbers are assigned to the target. Technical remote viewing can do two things. It keeps the student on the target, whether it's a student or a professional. It doesn't allow them, because of these error-correcting and error-trapping techniques, to lose the target. And it can be used for problem-solving as well as describing the geographical target. And that is a very powerful tool. Cause and effect.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, I don't know, percentage-wise, did you change 10, 20, 30% of the original protocols, half?
I think from coordinate remote viewing to technical remote viewing, the changes are probably nominally 45%. 45%
change. That's a fair change.
But the rigor has been up, has at least been tripled. Very rigorous technique.
And
there's flowcharts. I mean,
that's what I'm going to ask. The statistics they compiled during the 20 years of the military program, with regard to accuracy rates, how do you compare those to technical remote viewing's stats today?
The best of our military remote viewers, the best that we could do. Now, Joe McMonagall was a psychic, so he was not a trained remote viewer. I did not train Joe McMonagall. I trained Paul Smith and Mel Riley, for instance, in coordinate remote viewing. And I was a coordinate remote viewing viewer myself. Well, the best that we could do, we ran 60 to 65%. That was okay in terms of cross-cueing and directing other intelligence systems. But it could not be used as a standalone intelligence tool. I coined the term science a long time ago, independent of other people, psychic intelligence. And it really is not a standalone, nor should any intelligence collection tool be a standalone tool. But this could not have been until technical remote viewing was born and evolved. So we went from 60-65% to 85-90%. And that's a big jump.
And in some cases where you have multiple teams, you claim when you take on a project, I've heard you say it, Ed, that you actually can achieve 100%?
That's correct. With a team of six remote viewers, trained remote, technical remote viewers, team of six using the right controls, we can do 100%. Unfortunately, that can't be used in real-time situations because of the amount of time that it takes to solve a problem. Sometimes we need 2 weeks. So if we're dealing with a missing child or a stolen nuclear weapon or something like that that's on the move, this is not the right tool.
Last night, Ingo said something that is perhaps in contention with something you and I have talked about in the past and you've said. And that is, you know me, Ed, over the years I've become cynical and you know, I saw the Ted Koppel program, and they announced, yes, we did it for 20 years, but no, we're not doing it anymore because it doesn't work, they said in the program. Or they determined that it didn't work well enough, or whatever the hell they said on Ted Koppel. I don't know. Point is, almost every remote viewer I've talked to, you included, have said, the program is over. It's done. The U.S. government is now not conducting a program. And I asked Ingo, I'm sure you heard me last night.
I did.
Isn't it possible, Ingo, that a black level or two down deep, if this really works, we have to still be doing it? And is it not possible, Ingo, that we are still doing it? And he said, you bet.
It's possible that we are, but we're not. In fact, any of the trained technical remote viewers that our company has trained could actually turn their attention to locate such a program. And if they did, they would not find one. It's not being done. What the CIA did was damage control.
Have you done that?
Proactive.
Have you done that? Have you turned your attention to finding an ongoing program?
Yes.
And you haven't found one?
No. There's people with interest at high levels of government, and they have hip pocket attempts to try to resurrect this, but it's not going to happen for a number of reasons that we may or may not get into tonight. But what the CIA did was damage control. They wanted to put the kibosh on any attempt to have to explain this anymore, because it was a political embarrassment, to be honest with you. At the time they received the remnants of the Defense Intelligence Agency's program, it was all they had left was one ex-Army viewer and two crystal ball gazers. They were literally tarot card readers. And one was engaged in automatic writing. And it wasn't even a shadow of what the military program was. That is why I took the military viewers, and that is why I felt justified in doing it, because the Defense Intelligence Agency trashed the program. They threw it away.
But he said the Chinese are doing it.
Oh, yes. And they're very good.
And they're very good.
Yes.
All right. Well, then, in my mind, if we're not doing it, then we are neglecting our own national defense, Ed.
Well, the Chinese have stolen our W-88 warhead, so
I know.
We're neglecting our national defense in a lot of areas.
That's a good point. Ed, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. Major Ed Dames is my guest. SciTech's Ed Dames and more. We'll talk about that. Once again, for any information on the statement I made, you can go to my website, which is now www.artbell.com, or a new one, coasttocoastam.com. They'll take you to the same place.
Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
Coast to Coast AM in transition, actually. The announcement I made last hour is available on my website now, both in audio form and in text form. And my website is available in two ways. You may reach it by going to the normal comfortableartbell.com, www.artbell.com, or the new moniker, www.coasttocoastam.com. That's www.coasttocoastam.com, which will be accommodating the new 7-day-per-week program that's coming. So there you have it. In a moment, Ed Dames will be right back, and we'll get right back into it. Once again, the doctor, Dr. Doom, Major Ed Dames, a remote viewer, a technical remote viewer, as in SciTech, and more that we'll talk about. But I want to argue with you a little more. Ed, if it works, and you say it works, Ingo Swann says it works, and so many others say it works, and it obviously works, and we're not using it, and our potential enemies are, that's not the CIA and the NSA that I know. The NSA I know listens to all our phone conversations and our baby monitors. And so why wouldn't they be doing this?
There's some differences here. One is that one real reason, strong reason why we're not doing it is because this program, under various names, from Real Flame to Sun Street to Center Lane, all the psychic warfare unit, in all my days of dealing in black units, I've been in some of the blackest of the black, including NSA programs, I have never seen a unit or an organization that was subject to more ostracism, more damning comments, was more of a white elephant than that psychic unit. It was a hot potato. It was passed from the Army, the DIA, the CIA at one point. The Navy tried to get it. CIA tried to get it in its early days. And it was a bastard child. It was fraught with associations with the occult. It was the scariest thing in town. It was the most desirable thing in town, in a town where knowledge is power. You can imagine when people were briefed on the existence of the unit, what they wanted to do with it, wanted to use it for personal use. Indeed, some of the senators on the Senate Intel Committee, first thing they started doing when they were briefed on the operation was to actually try to use it for personal gain. So it was a real strange animal, and oversight committees could not handle it. So the baby went out with the bathwater.
So you're sure?
Yeah, I am sure. Remember now, things have changed. We don't do wet operations in the government anymore. We may farm that out to other organizations.
I'm very glad you mentioned wet operations, mm-hmm. because another subject I covered with Ingo last night that you and I have talked about is remote influencing or psychokinesis. I don't know which word you want to use, remote influencing, I suppose. But we got right down to it last night, and I pinned down Ingo, and I said, Ingo, would it be possible to burst a blood vein in the head of that twerp over there in Iraq? And he said, yes, it would.
We spent a lot of time on this, Art. A lot of time trying to work this problem. If we could have burst the blood vein in Saddam Hussein's head, we would have done it long ago.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Now, when we had the war, we could have gone in and kicked his butt where he lived, but we opted not to do it.
Now, I told you why in earlier shows, why we did not do that. Now, there were other governments that we could have paid to do it, but that history would not look kindly upon the United States had we paid other governments to go in and bomb Saddam Hussein when he had children all around him.
Okay, but even in successive operations where we've lobbed these cruise missiles in there, you know, to send a message after he's misbehaved in some manner or another, fired at our planes, lit him up with radar, whatever. In all the successful operations, we probably could have killed him, Ed, if we'd wanted to. But we have this thing, apparently, about Iraq falling apart, Iran taking over.
Yes.
And so
exactly.
We don't...
And also all the loans to Iran, to Iraq.
So we don't quite really want him out of the way fully. We just want him shut down.
You want banks want to be able to keep those loans on the books.
Right.
Not erase them.
Right. Mm-hmm. So even if we could burst a blood vessel in his putrid little head, we might not do it. We might just let him sort of keep limping along, which is the way we like it, with Iran kept at bay. Is that not somewhat logical?
Well, you know, there in the days when I was in the unit and other units like that, we were a little bit, there were some loose cannons. I was one of them. We could have experimented with things like this, and indeed we did.
Yes.
That's why oversight came down so tightly on units like ours. Oliver North got caught in the same way, getting a little bit loose with...
So then you wouldn't say that it would be impossible to remote influence in that manner? But
it may not be impossible, but nobody knows how to do it yet. The earliest, the most of the energies in this area, historically, in the last 30 years, were done by my erstwhile Soviet counterparts, Ivan Sokolov, the head of the KGB team of extrasensors. They started out with frogs, and then they moved to rabbits.
Uh-huh.
They tried to kill frogs by stopping the frogs' hearts,
right,
using the team's mind.
Right.
They moved to rabbits after that. Indeed, the U.S. Secret Service came to our unit and asked, when they found out via intelligence leads, that the Soviets were engaged in this type of research.
Did they kill any frogs there?
It was never quite clear. I talked to, after the Cold War was over, I talked to my counterpart, KGB, and they did have some success, but it was sporadic. It was not consistent. And in military operations, you better darn well be consistent. Let me give you an example what I mean by consistency. Everybody talks about chemical weapons, but if you're a combat commander, you would much rather use hot steel on the target than a chemical weapon, not because you don't admire the effectiveness of a chemical weapon to neutralize and kill,
yes,
but because it's subject to the vicissitudes of wind and weather and heat and deterioration by ultraviolet radiation, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And since you haven't dealt with it so much in training, you're loath to use it on an enemy in combat. So that's what I mean about consistency, training to fight over and over again. You want something that you can depend on. And the Soviets could not depend on their power to stop a heart,
mm-hmm,
or influence somebody remotely.
Do you think it's possible, though, that if anybody can do it or has done it, that maybe Ingo, because of his answer, can do it?
No, I've seen this attempted before. What gets in the way, and this may come as a surprise to you, what gets in the way of its effective use is guardian angels. It turns out that people who have guardian angels, the guardian angel blocks the attack.
Now, here's another place that I want to draw a line. Ingalls was very careful. You are a loose cannon compared to Ingo. In other words, Ingo only went for verifiable targets, real-time verifiable targets. He would never...
That's what he'll say in the open. But in the closet, Ingo went after targets that were very different.
I agree with you. He actually said, with regard to the moon, there's stuff there, and it belongs to them. That was it. Those were Ingo's words.
Mm-hmm.
So, in addition to that, he talked about extraterrestrial contact in quite a bit of detail. So, yeah, you know, you're really right, but during the period that he was doing his initial work, he apparently tried to stay pretty much with verifiable targets. You, on the other hand, have moved into looking into the future, something he admitted last night, by the way, is absolutely possible, looking into the future events on a massive scale. And you've had a lot of luck with things like frogs. I could sit here and detail all the things you've had hits on, and a few misses over the years, but you've had a lot of hits with regard to the weather and the environment. You've had a great deal of success, but you've moved out of the the very strict regimen of only going after immediately verifiable targets. So that's fair to say?
That is fair to say. In the same way that the best analogy to use would be, let's take an Air Force bomber pilot. The bomber pilot trains over and over again to drop in training in Nevada and places like that, to drop a bomb on the target or to mark a target and drop a bomb. And, you know, in the old days, you didn't have a laser guidance. So you dropped the bomb using the gun sight. And there was something, you know, if it was a hot target and people were shooting at you, the Air Force had a saying, one pass, haul ass. You know, that's what you did, and you prayed that that bomb would get to the target.
Yep.
And then when you got back to base, you propped your feet up on a table and you had your cup of coffee, then the commander would say, here's what your mission did. And based upon that feedback, you knew whether or not you had to correct your aim. Well, remote viewing is the same way. So that after you practice time after time after time after time again on training targets, and you can validate the success rates, then you get a pretty good feel for how, in terms of confidence, for how close you are against unknowns, because that's what intelligence is all about. You don't care about the knowns. You want to go after the unknowns, right? That's why this tool was created.
Of course.
So that's where Ingo, that's why I said goodbye to Ingo. Thank you very much. I'll take that. And off we went. Because we were trying to use it not against practice targets. That's what Ingo did to validate not only the efficacy, but the existence of this skill, this trainable skill. We wanted to use it against the unknowns. What did the Chinese and the Soviets have inside that building? Who was in charge and where was the biochemical warfare program? What kind of agents were they making? This kind of thing. All unknown. Otherwise, we wouldn't have spent so much money on it. Incidentally, I'm being called back. I'm being called by a number of combat war fighters to train their teams. Not intelligence agencies, but war fighters. Government war fighters.
Really? But, really? Really? When did that occur?
Oh, it's been occurring for the past 6 months.
I rest
people know.
Listen, if they knocked on your door and you didn't answer, they're going to go knock on another door somewhere and somebody's going to answer.
No, they won't, because we're the best there is. They've got the training, they've got the company's training tapes, and they know how effective they are, and they want more. They want the advantage.
Listen, last night, Ingo, I asked Ingo this about the scariest remote viewing he had ever done. And he recounted his remote viewing session of the East German prison biological weapons facility underground. Ingo described a very experimental event. I asked him how much transference there is. In other words, he was seeing humans, he was feeling humans suffering the most horrible experimentation and horrible sort of thing going on in East Germany that that you could imagine in your worst nightmare. And he talked about transference, and I asked him how much transference there was, and he said almost total.
Well, first of all, incidentally or tangentially, that was not East Germany. That was Russia. It was way in the hinterlands of Russia. I remember that mission. It was an underground biological warfare test center where political prisoners from the gulags were being used as subjects.
He may have.
They went down. Once they went down, they never came back out.
He may have changed the place for some. You know, he didn't want to save the place. It doesn't matter. The point I was trying to get to was a transference question. In other words, he found that almost unbearable. Unbearable. And if you remote view, for example, a murder or something horrible, Ed, do you find that to be true, that the transference can be almost unbearable if it's that bad?
It depends upon the person. If you've got a person who is a coward, for instance, a person who scares easily, a person who's not used to being around a battle, they're not going to be effective remote viewing those scenes, because, yes, you do get real close. First of all, emotionally, you react emotionally before you ever are aware of what you're reacting to. your emotions get hit first. I could say much more about that, technically speaking, in terms of psychokinesis, and perhaps I will later. But yes, you become caught up in the emotionality of the target, and you need to be able to shunt that. Now, we teach people in our business, in technical remote viewing, how to do that correctly. And Ingo, in fact, was the one who discovered the process of how to allow those emotions, one's own reaction to the target, which he called an aesthetic impact, how to make sure that dissipates before you continue. But he was a natural psychic, a natural sensitive. So in a case like that, where he's surrounded by death and dying of a horrible type, it is very difficult for him to continue a session without breaking down.
Sure.
Where someone like me would say, "Oh, you know what? Put my pen down for a few minutes, take a 2 minute break, and be right back in there."
Hey,
I've seen so much of that in my life.
You can do that, huh?
I could do that, yes.
All right, well, let me tell you just a brief story. I worked for a year as a 911 dispatcher for Monterey County, responsible for, you know, picking up a 911 call, dispatching the proper force, police, fire, whatever. And, Ed, I've told you, I think, a couple of times, I have not gone beyond your first tape to embrace remote viewing. And I think I now know why I haven't. For the same reason that I had to leave 911 dispatching, because I couldn't handle it, Ed. I took that home with me. Sometimes children would die. Police on my shift would get shot. I would go home, and I would be so stressed by it all that I'd be in tears.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think I'm a good candidate to remote view in the spirit of what Ingo said about transference.
It happens with me that way with children. The Christmas before last, I tried desperately to find the missing girl. I failed. I had everything going for me, but it was still a failure. And when I could see her, I knew where she was. I knew that I didn't have much time left before her captor would kill her. And I broke down too, because I knew I was failing. I knew I was going to lose this job. And it isn't my fault that she was not rescued, but you start to take these things personally when you spend so much time on target.
Yeah,
I remember Paul Smith looking to we were tracking down for Ross Perot was in town, Washington, D.C.
You're going to have to hold that thought.
All right.
We'll be right back. Transference. Can you imagine that? Having to live what the victim is going through in order to try to figure it all out. I could just never do it. I took it home with me every night. And eventually, the luggage got too heavy. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Up through tarmac to the sun again.
aid? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may recharge at area code 775-727-1222. Or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed. And in a moment, I think I've got something I would like to ask Ed about. He may know something about it. If not, it's going to make a wonderful task for him. And then we have a lot of specifics I want to ask about, because there's a lot going on out there. Volcanoes are blowing up. Ice is falling off the Ross Ice Shelf. Big pieces of ice. The environment is moving as never before, certainly in our lifetimes. Lots to ask about, lots that Ed has talked about in the past, but we appear to be getting closer. Stay right where you are. Again, back to Major Ed Deems. Let me begin here, Ed, and you may not have any enlightenment for us tonight because it's something relatively new, although it's old as well. Richard Hoagland preceded you tonight, and for a long time he has talked about a split between interagency split in NASA. He's talked about things that are on Mars and the Moon that, by the way, Ingo certainly talked about last night. And, you know, people have had healthy skepticism about it all. But now we find out that in a speech given by the head of NASA, he acknowledges the close cooperation, help, whatever, of Mr. Inman from NSA and CIA fame and so forth and so on. And it seems to me to be strange bedfellows and lends some credence to the argument Richard has that a lot is being hidden from us, Ed, that probes are being destroyed, perhaps purposely. You know, that there's information waiting for us on Mars that will change everything we believe about ourselves. Could you take a look at NASA? Could you take a look at the probes? Could you take a look at Mars? Or how much of that have you done? Are there really two agencies? What's going on?
No, there are two missions. NASA has two missions.
Two missions?
Yeah. It puts two types of things into space. It puts civilian missions into space, the typical space exploration, the science missions, and it puts intelligence packages into space. So it has launch vehicles that do both. So there are two arms. Some, as you know, some shuttle missions are all military officers. And loose-lipped sink ships, and those missions aren't talked about. Except to say that a classified satellite was put into orbit or something like that.
Well, I understand that. But what about the bigger one, Mars, previous civilizations, artifacts that... I had a professor here the other night who said he heard directly from a JPL employee that they don't want to find something important on Mars. Dr. Brandenburg.
Well, there are individuals in that. There are individuals at JPL, as there have been in the past 10 or 15 years, who have data that they believe supports the existence of what in the very... what was called in the old days non-fractal images.
Mm-hmm.
A conservative word to say that something is there that is possibly not natural. But NASA's mission, NASA's space exploration mission, is different than the SETI program. Everybody's got their own little bailiwick. NASA's primary mission is to study the geophysics, the geology, the space exploration in general. It's not extraterrestrial intelligence. That's a different animal. It's somebody else's job, the SETI program in this case. SETI, however, only listens. So there really isn't a niche here that it can be effectively filled by anybody. NASA would have to form a whole new group within itself in order to fund and man something that would explore the possibility that there's life or was life of an intelligent kind on the surface of Mars. That's the way it is, Art. That's just the way it is.
That's just the way it is.
In the old days, in the intelligence community, I ran into similar things. Let's say that there are things on Mars, and I have said that myself using our work and military team's work. We support the idea that there are non-fractal structures. There are structures, artificial structures on both Mars and the Moon. Now, when there was an intelligence agency, I won't mention which one, that did an in-house look at itself as to why a particular government was crumbled without us being able to predict that. And the bottom line was it crumbled because the intelligence community labored under, and I quote, the will not to believe, unquote. And what that meant was we had all the indicators in front of us. This government was coming down from the inside out. We were supporting a government, the United States was, our State Department, was supporting a president in a foreign country that was ready to fall. And we just didn't want to believe that was the case, that our boy was going down. And this is a similar situation in any bureaucracy. Bureaucracies are their own worst enemies many times.
So then, if I'm hearing you correctly, this is not a project you need to undertake because you already know the answer.
I don't care what NASA is doing. The military team, what we did on the military team and what we've been doing in SciTech since 89 was looking at Mars and the Moon, and including INGO. We put together our own studies. Some of those are out and about. Our conclusions about what is out there. Ironically, this is a kind of a funny anecdotal story. I offered in 1990 to assist Richard Hoagland to put together a remote viewing survey of Cydonia crater at a dirt cheap contract price. He held that up in front of a UN subcommittee and said, "This SciTech is a CIA front organization trying to move in on me." Which, you know, I thought, well, this is crazy. And a year later, Richard Hoagland found out all about remote viewing and found out that Ingo Swann was the father of remote viewing, visited him in New York. Ingo Swann turns to Richard G. Hoagland and says, "Well, I don't do things like this, but there's a group of my students who put together a company that does this professionally, and they're really good." "Oh, what's their name?" "Well, it's SciTech, run by Ed Dames."
Well, Ed, now, come on. Can you imagine that somebody might imagine you still, you know, it said once CIA, always CIA. Once a comedy guy, always a comedy guy. So was it so outrageous to imagine he might still have had some connection with the boys?
No, not at all. Just relating the story.
Listen, I want to talk about some incredible things that have occurred in the Antarctic. My God, we have had two gigantic icebergs break from the Ross ice shelf, not Larsen B, but the Ross ice shelf, very worrisome, just break off, and they're sort of sitting there bobbing and bumping up against each other right now, but they will inevitably take off, block shipping. Now, how big? One of these is 80 miles by 12 miles. The larger one is 183 miles by 23 miles, clearly seen
by satellite. The big one, for example, it was said, has more fresh water in it, Ed, than all of the annual rainfall for the entire world's land mass for a year. Now, that's a lot of fresh water. That's a lot of fresh water. And here comes a second iceberg. The Ross Ice Shelf seems to be breaking apart, Ed. What the hell is going on?
Well, our environment is collapsing, in no uncertain terms. As I've mentioned before, let me give you a little perspective on what I do in terms of living and my research. You know that we call, in technical remote viewing, we call this database that we go to the matrix. It's a term that was coined by Ingo Swann himself. Think of the matrix as a great big library, the Akashic records, the collective unconscious. It doesn't matter what name you give it. It's the storage center, the sea of all patterns of information, all knowledge. The way that you and I exist is a pattern of information. The way that the planet exists through time as a pattern of information. All things, all knowledge. So as a professional in my job, I'm in this library. I have all this knowledge available to me. Now, I may be able to pick up a book off of a shelf and not understand it because it's beyond my ken. Let's say I'm dealing with something mundane like particle physics. Well, I could go to another book and look at the social, economic, and political ramifications of particle physics in the future and understand that, even though I don't understand the mechanics of particle physics, right?
Sure.
So all that knowledge is there. So a question becomes, what in the hell to look at? What's important? And over the last almost 20 years of this work, that question itself becomes important. What, in terms of epistemology, science and knowledge, what knowledge does one want? What is important? So what I began doing a number of years ago was, this library is not just a static piece of knowledge base. It isn't that. It is interactive and in some cases proactive. It's as if the librarian in this library was there and could be not only a librarian to pull a book off the shelf for you, but could teach you to ask the right questions.
It's almost a living, changing thing.
It is. It's a living, dynamic, interactive, and proactive thing. So what I have done, using various search terms, submitting various library cards, if you will, over and over again, with different requests, in different ways, taking different tasks to explore, is to ask the librarian, using our own technical remote viewing search terms, ask the librarian what questions are important to ask for myself and for humankind right now.
Right.
Not sometime in a distant future, but right now.
Yes.
And when those questions are asked, all of them result in the same thing. The sun. Our sun. And so the study, the remote, technical remote viewing study of the sun has become extremely important. And what I've learned and what I've been stating is that the sun and Project Star, Sunburst, SpaceX's former Project Sunburst, we determined that the sun is going to do something very radical. And now we have more information on that.
Well, Ed, the sun is getting pretty radical right now. My limited knowledge, I monitor the sun very closely, and it's going absolutely berserk right now. A lot of scientists thought that this cycle, 23, was going to be a very mild, disappointing cycle in terms of activity. They're all beginning to change their tune now. It's going totally berserk up there. I mean berserk. CMEs all over the place. Flares of 4 and 5 at a time.
5 yesterday.
5.
5 today, probably to celebrate your announcement. 3 yesterday. That's, this is some extraordinary activity, and it's picking up. But what we know, what we can describe in terms of predictive intelligence. Remember, intelligence, and that's where we have, that's the genesis of remote viewing, intelligence as an intelligence tool. Reconnaissance has to be predictive to be useful. You know, who wants, it doesn't talk about history. So what I'm describing now is a very large flare. It's going to come off the sun. It's going to come off the sun, and it's going to collapse the Earth's magnetic field. And it will essentially cook us all, parboil us for about 6 or 7 days. Plasma, very big ball of plasma.
Well, you're certainly nothing if not consistent. You've been saying this for a long time. And your new information is basically that this will occur over a several-day period of time.
Probably around 5 or 6 days. It's going to be a big one. It's going to be a long-duration flare or a series of back-to-back, very, very powerful flares.
I am told by scientists that our magnetic field could, in fact, collapse. That could happen. And if that did happen, then our protection against what would come next is kind of like shields down.
That's right.
Is that a fair analogy?
It is, and it's going to hurt us. It will create some serious storms. And speaking of storms, Houston's going to get hit by a tornado in the next couple of days too. That just popped in when I was remote viewing the other day, looking at weather. But you know, the sun.
Houston is going to get hit by a tornado.
Yes.
Soon.
Like the Houston area is going to get it.
Soon.
Yeah, it looks like it's soon.
I killed them off the other day by mistake. It was, of course, not Houston at all.
Oh, did you actually mention Houston?
I mentioned Houston by mistake.
Oh, you were just premature, that's all.
God, I
premature
hope not.
Yeah, it's coming. But the most important thing I have to say, particularly now, since we are not going to be here together in this venue, again, the most important thing that I want to leave you with is this. Earth's ozone layer is not going to repair itself. It is decaying at a rate now that's beyond the threshold for self-repair. This ozone layer that took 2.5 billion years to establish on Earth is not going to repair itself in 50 years, no matter what anybody says about discontinuing the use of CFEs and all those catalysts that destroy the ozone layer. It's coming down. And that is the most serious information that the librarian in this grand library in the sky is pointing out to mankind. Anybody that's trained in technical remote viewing, tens of thousands of people now, turn your attention to the most important, the most valuable information, the most valuable message that mankind needs to know. You'll come up with the same thing. And that is destruction of Earth's ozone layer. And that is more serious than anything we can deal with, including nuclear war.
Ed, the sun is maybe approaching a peak. I don't know. Over the next 6 months, year, I don't know. And they don't really know either. They sort of guess. They know only when we have passed the peak that the peak has occurred. So they don't really know. But you think this series of flares, very, very serious flares, is coming how soon? I know timelines are the most difficult, but best guess?
The only marker that I have in terms of time is that when we attempted to determine whether Y2K, what the results of the so-called Y2K event would be.
I remember you
we
said...
We went 2 years back trying to... And we said, hey, it's a non-event.
I remember
it's
that.
Eclipsed by a solar flare.
That's right.
So I think because I think it's very close to the year 2000.
All right. Ed, hold on. We'll be right back. We're at the top of the hour already. Ed did indeed say that about Y2K. Timelines are the most difficult thing. All remote viewers say that. But Ed has been consistent with what he said about the sun. We'll be right back.
Kingdom of Nye at 1-775-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Majorette Dames is here. I'm Art Bell, and it's good to have you along. I'm notified that some people are having... It may be that I'm getting so much email that my email account has clogged up. If that's the case, you can continue to try and email me at, as I mentioned a little while ago, either one of two accounts. A Mindspring, which may be sprung because of the number of messages, or, of course, artbell@aol.com as well. So we'll just leave it at that and see if it all repairs itself after it has a chance to catch its breath. Ed Dames will be right back. To Major Ed Dames, and Ed, there was something we were supposed to cover that we didn't, and I just got a fact saying be sure you ask Ed to mention the volcano in North America that he's concerned about. Good point.
It isn't that I'm concerned about it. It was just something that the company looked at years ago, the next volcanic eruption in North America. That is actually not that easy a target. We believe it's Mammoth Mountain area. But the reason it's difficult to do is because when you sketch the area that is the next eruption,
right,
it looks so similar to Mount Bachelor and other areas like that on the West Coast. We can pretty easily determine that we're in a West Coast area because of topography and the species of trees and flora and fauna that are there. But to actually compare it to a map to a map overlay, that takes a while. It takes a lot of sketching, a lot of work, a lot of different perspective. You have to know what you're doing in terms of the geometry of the target, and so it took us a while to determine that it was Mammoth Lake. The extent of the eruption, it doesn't look like it's going to be that heavy. It doesn't look like it's going to be that big, but it's going nevertheless to be an eruption. So that's all.
The age-old question, of course, people will be asking, timeline. Sorry, I have to even ask, because I know the answer, really. But
yeah, we don't know. This one, we really don't know. And anyway, it's not as near as important as other things that are happening. I'd like to mention one thing that in terms of a project that I was looking at. I, like you, are very interested in UFOs and the idea of extraterrestrials.
Sure.
Inger Swan and I go way back in terms of this arena, you know, long before there was a SciTech. Inger Swan and Ed Dames were looking at the UFO problem. Well, lately, what I've decided to do was to look at the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence artifacts on planet Earth. Because artifacts don't move around like things in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to them, and it would be a reasonable person would say that wasn't made here. And then maybe deduce some things about intelligence that left it behind, right?
Reasonable,
so
yes.
I pursued that as a project. But I got a few surprises when I did that, because it didn't take me long to realize that I was on to something, and I began to sketch this something, and this something was not an artificial object. It was a valley, very big, broad valley. But when you go in remote viewing, the search terms are literal: extraterrestrial artifacts, present time, and I'm sketching a valley in response to that particular search term. The valley happens to be the Great Rift Valley in Africa. The center of mass of my sketches was Tanzania. And that it was just the valley itself. So I did some more work. And to make a long story short, we don't have a lot of time. Do you know what the artifact is? This great extraterrestrial artifact?
No.
It's DNA.
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 Oh, here we go again. Full circle.
The
DNA.
The artifact is DNA. The gardeners who planted the original seed planted it not in... They planted it in us, in whatever our the proto-human was, whatever that proto-human was in the Rift Valley area around Olduvai Gorge, where the Leakeys worked, whatever that proto-human was that was changed, it was changed because an extraterrestrial race manipulated the DNA in that species and changed it. So that it transformed into the what we are today, modern-day Homo sapiens. Okay? So, here we are. Our SETI program is listening into outer space and not hearing anything. And all this time, the answer is in inner space. We should be listening to signals from inner space.
That sure
because
is
that there's patterns in our DNA that haven't been discovered yet. When they are, very interesting things will happen. So that's where my work is centered these days. The Earth is a garden. There are other garden worlds. Just because we're destroying this one, and that doesn't mean there aren't many other worlds like it. The only thing that leaves these planet, these garden worlds, are souls. That's it. Souls leave. That's what's being harvested.
Harvested, yeah. I knew that word was coming up, harvested. And they go metaphorically in different directions, do they not?
Not metaphorically.
They go literally.
In directions. The 99% of the unaccounted for gravity in the universe is possibly from what we call dark matter. There's a whole lot of worlds out there. Those worlds are reconstruction worlds. It's where your soul goes, and it gets dropped into another form. If you're lucky.
Wow. If you're lucky, yeah, right.
So those are physical worlds, just because they're a little bit different in terms of material. Let's call it vibration, to use a New Age term. Doesn't mean they're not there. They're accounting for a whole lot of the gravity that we can't account for using visual observations.
You know, I've talked earlier tonight about my career. What about yours, Ed? I'd like to get a kind of a bead on where you're going from here, what you see, what lies ahead for Ed Dames, what projects. I certainly know that you're on to the medical aspect of AIDS and cancer, a worthy endeavor indeed. What else lies ahead for you, you think?
I honestly don't know, Art. I know that... I know that the most important thing in an individual's life is one's soul. That it's been a long road to get to that knowledge. And knowledge stops there. There's no more need for knowledge for me after I personally have reached that point. What good is knowledge? The growth of one's soul is important in terms of down where the rubber meets the road in a three-dimensional world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you foster the development and the growth of a soul? And that is, that's where I'm at now. And I don't know what the rules are necessarily, so...
It's not a clear picture for you then.
No, I just know that knowledge, it's time where knowledge has served me well, personally. I can't speak for others. And the idea of gaining any more knowledge drops out of the picture.
Mm.
It's more of, it's other things now. Things that I'm learning in another way. So I don't know where I'm going. I like to teach, and there's a new career here. You know, I like the idea of saving lives. You know, always harbored the idea personally of being a doctor, and was a pre-med student at one point. But it was too boring for me.
Huh.
So I left it at Berkeley. Well, it's a nice thing to be, and I admire doctors. I have great respect for doctors.
Well, that tells me a little bit about why you're moving in the direction you're moving now, perhaps. And maybe you can be of great assistance in medicine with your talent. And
well, I would like to be able to, I would like to train physicians, and rather than physicists, rather than military intelligence officers, I feel drawn to train physicians. And so that's what I shall do.
Well, I wish there was more time. My father is in the final stages of a metastasized cancer in his lungs now, and that's a situation that a lot of people are facing all around the world right now, is this cancer thing, this horrible cancer thing. And I sure would like to see something happen.
Well, this tool that our tax dollars went to developing, this remote viewing tool, it is a powerful tool. And I would like to apply it towards specifically the cancer and AIDS. Now, we've looked over the years quietly. You know, the military team days, we looked at things like leukemias and Lou Gehrig's disease, and we've studied them. We didn't tell the public what we were doing, even in the early days of SciTech, because we didn't want to get people's hopes up, even when we were successful, and we were in numerous cases. But in those days, I was not interested that much in, you know, in medicine. We were still interested in other things. But I've come full circle now.
That's really interesting. You and I have been doing interviews over the years now, long enough that I've seen you morph yourself in terms of your own interests have become very spiritual compared to our very early interviews. The message has not wavered. You've always said the same thing about what will occur, what's coming. But your approach to it has become far more spiritual in the last, couple of years, I think, Ed.
I would agree. I'd agree.
Maybe since the encounter with Father Malachi Martin, I think that's when it began to occur to you. You remember, we recently, as a matter of fact, replayed that show in which you interacted with Father Martin. And
someone mentioned that, yes, to me.
Mm-hmm. Did they?
Yes. I wanted to go toe-to-toe with Father Malachi Martin on this idea of remote viewing and whether or not it was good or evil or those kinds of things. And what I mentioned was that you don't take your idea of, you don't take your ethics, don't drop away when remote view. What needs to drop away is your ego. Now, your ego may pop back after the session's over, but it better not be in that remote viewing session. Otherwise, it's going to destroy your data tremendously.
Well, I have no problem admitting that I've had a pretty big ego.
Oh, both of us. In terms of, I was king of arrogance for many years. I was a cavalry officer and others, and, you know, the best. But it boils down to the golden rule and being a good Samaritan. I mean, if you can treat strangers, absolute strangers, in a loving way, then that's a challenge. I mean, I like challenges, but these are big ones. You know, really look into your heart and say that you care about a stranger. That's talk about challenge. That's a big one for me.
But how do you consciously, in a session, take an ego that really does still exist in the world, you know, in the everyday world, and go into a remote viewing session and squish it?
Oh, that's easy to do when you're remote viewing. It's easy to do when you're meditating. It's tough to do when you're relating to other people. That's when your buttons are pushed. You can go off and sit in the mountain and do all kinds of wonderful meditative sessions. You can remote view and do a great job. But the buttons, the ego buttons don't get pushed until you start comparing yourself with others, until you start, you know, the one-upsmanship, that kind of thing. Those buttons don't get pushed except until you're around other people. You know, the saints, hey, they're, you know, they're cop-outs. They go off by themselves, but they don't have to worry about those buttons being pushed. It's true.
Well, what I would like to do, at risk, and I'm going to instruct my audience now, I do want to take some calls, but with regard to the announcement I made in the second hour of the program, I do not want to talk about that. I want to take questions for Ed Dame. So if you have questions for Ed, and only if you have questions for Ed, should you be dialing right now, and of course all the lines have been going readily all night long, I'm going to take a chance and dip in, but I want the subject to be what it is, remote viewing. So here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning. Turn your radio off, please.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, I would like to know if Major Dames, I don't know how religious he is, but the Bible says that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. There are heavens, but God created the heaven and the earth. And the scripture says that this heaven and earth shall pass away in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, and we shall be caught up with him in the midair. And I would like to know what's your thought on that.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's related to, to the idea of the rapture and those kinds of things. But
do you think that heaven is literal? I think that there is a hell. I think there's a heaven.
I think that a heaven and hell exist right here on earth. You know, you're 1 foot in heaven, 1 foot in hell. It's recreated. It's right here.
It's space, and heaven is a prepared place.
Sometimes, like, sometimes you have 1 foot in hell and the other on a banana peel.
Okay. On a banana. Just hope we don't slip. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, and take care. Wild card line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
How you doing?
Okay. Where are you?
Pretty good. I had a question about, you said you remote viewed Lucifer.
Yes.
I was wondering, you know, Lucifer is one of the fallen angels. I was wondering if you had ever remote viewed any other fallen angels, and how did they compare with your remote viewing of Lucifer?
Very different. Very different indeed. Lucifer could be described as a brilliant, absolutely beautiful, crystalline entity. Cold, crystalline, more beautiful than anything you could imagine, entity. So beautiful. Now. You know, and somewhere in space-time. But it is the most, it is something that can look right through you. It feels like you're completely penetrated by this presence. And when that happens, it's the coldest, most horrible feeling imaginable.
What about some of the other angels?
The only other ones I looked at were Satan and a lieutenant of Satan's. The lieutenant, I think, is called in the vernacular the devil, and there are other many languages have names for him. They're nothing like Lucifer. They're different in form. And although we can't perceive the form of angels, we have ideas about them, and the ideas that about Satan and its lieutenant. I don't know if the angels are sexed, but its lieutenant and Lucifer were very, very different.
Does that help you? Caller? I don't know where the caller is. Somehow we lost the caller.
We've never, as remote viewers, been able to discern the form of an angel. We know they're there. We know a lot about them. But we can't sketch them, and we can't discern the form.
All right.
Historically, when they pop into this dimension, you know, they are described as light. People pine away when they disappear. It's probably one of the reasons why angels don't appear a lot, because the apparition is so beautiful that people are loath to see them go and pine away.
I'm just happy to know they're there, Ed.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ed Dames. Hi.
Hello, I'm calling from Waco, Texas.
Waco.
Could you tell me a little bit more about your prediction for the tornado in Houston and give us a little bit of a time frame, please?
My guess is anywhere from right now to a week from now. That's my best estimate. It's a very big tornado, And
and everybody should bear in mind timelines are tough.
Yeah, and it's close or in Houston. I know it's right around the Gulf Coast, and other than that, I can't pin it down any further.
It sure was shocking to see one in Fort Worth. I mean, to see it hit a city. There were two tornadoes, actually, in Fort Worth. And to see one smash into a high-rise building was absolutely unbelievable. I don't think that I've ever seen that before.
Do you remember the Miami film? Miami footage last year.
Oh, my God, yes, I do.
Right, going down, right through downtown.
Yep. Hold on. We'll be right back to you. I'm Art Bell.
West of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
Good morning, everybody. Major at Dames, Sidex Major at Dames is here. And we're into phone calls now, so if you have a question, well, that's what that little instrument you have called a telephone is for. We will continue with all of that momentarily. Stay right where you are. Back to Major Ed Dames. Ed, here we go. Final assault toward the top of the hour here.
Fire away.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Where are you?
Georgia.
Georgia. All right.
Major Ames. I mean, Dames. I'd like to ask you a question. On your, oh, what you call that internet thing then? Thing?
You mean his website?
Yeah. Is there information on how to get books on distant viewing?
Remote viewing.
Yeah.
All right. So, in other words, are there literary references, Ed?
There aren't any references to books. The company is specialized in teaching this. And so we have our teaching videotapes, and there aren't any books.
You can't
learn this from a book. It was thought for many years it would be impossible to learn it from a videotape until I put together a training program that took many years to do. But a book just can't do it. You need to see it, see somebody do it.
Ed, are you ever going to write a book not about how to remote view, but about your life, perhaps?
I wasn't going to do it, but my vice president talked me into doing it. So
really?
Yes. Yeah, so I probably will do that, but I don't know if I want to commit to it. It's just, you know, that it's... The money is good, but...
Well, you will find it one of the more difficult things you've ever tackled. You'll sit down and you'll decide what kind of book you want to write and whether you want to be bluntly honest about it. And then if that's what you do and you sit down and you write a really bluntly honest book, you will find it an extremely painful process, probably akin to a full life review upon passage from this world.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm running into in terms of that. I'm not so sure I want to do that, you know.
Yep, believe me, I understand. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling from KFAR, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Far away indeed.
Absolutely. Just a couple of things I wanted to ask, and I will hang up and listen to the question. Major Dames, I wanted to ask you if you could please comment on that unusual alignment of the planets.
I can tell you right now, it's another non-event like Y2K, as far as I'm concerned.
Another non-event.
It's pretty in the sky, that's all.
Oh, okay. And I wanted to ask you also if you had any information or comment on, like, the western part of the United States, you know, going underwater.
Nope, I don't have any knowledge of that, and as far as I'm concerned, it's apocryphal.
And not going to happen.
Right.
So California's safe.
I didn't say that.
California is not necessarily...
I just didn't say it would be submarine.
I understand. First time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Not bad. How are you, Ed?
All right. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Ontario, Canada.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I followed Ed Dames for quite a while, and I'm very impressed with what he does, and I think it's a great thing he does. What my question was is, how does the sunspots affect our bodies?
Ah.
I don't know, but I think that is a good question, and it would be...
It is, because I'm told, Ed, that we have a substance called magnetite.
Yeah, that's true, in the back of our neck. Huh?
Yeah, uh-huh. And that would be perhaps affected by a gigantic blast from the sun, one could imagine.
It is indeed one of the things that may... there's an event that happens in the future that has been described by prophets of old, and that is where people drop to the ground. And I had often entertained the thought that maybe it is because of this magnetic effect, because of the magnetite in our bodies, that we may become disoriented by a big pulse, an electromagnetic pulse from the sun. But I'm not sure. I think this is a good question. I have not investigated it, but I may now.
All right. West, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello. Hello.
Hello, Art. Ed. I guess I should ask this question. Ed, can you see if Art's going to be back?
No.
After the time he said going to be back?
Sir, I asked you not to ask these kinds of questions.
Well, I didn't ask you.
Well, all right. Ed, don't touch that with a 10-foot pole. First time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
Hi, my name is Terry, and I'm from Troy, Missouri.
Hello, Terry.
Hi. I'd like to find out how to get a hold of Ed Dames' fax line, and because I didn't quite pick that up when you guys must have mentioned that earlier.
No, we didn't mention it. I don't know if he wants to. Do you have a fax line, Ed?
We have a fax line for our orders only.
Oh, do you have
something you want to write to me? You can write to me at eddames at tiki.net, T-I-K-I dot net.
T-I-K-I?
Yes.
Tiki?
Tiki.
Tiki.net.
Okay, and that's, do you have a website too?
Yes, www.scitech.net. P-S-I-T-E-C-H.
P as in Paul, S-I,
yes.
Right?
Yes. P as in Paul.
All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Hey, Art. This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John.
Ed, on a past program, I heard you mention that you were very familiar with the Seth material by Jane Roberts.
Yes, I am.
very interesting stuff. I've read a good bit of it myself, and I've also read a lot of the works by Carlos Castaneda, and I was wondering if you were also familiar with his book, because a lot of the things that are in his works sound very familiar with what you and other remote viewers are saying about the nature of perception and the soul and intent and will and how to manage it.
Well, you know, truth is truth, and this TRV is just one perceptual mechanism, and it was designed to... we don't have any monopoly in my company or as professional remote viewers on the truth. Technical remote viewing was designed to deal with technical problems in this age, in this era, in time. That's all. And so it's just that it's just one tool, one perceptual tool that's specialized to solve technical problems.
You say you remote viewed your own death. You said you can't visualize what angels look like. Can you visualize what your own soul looks like?
Yes, to some degree, yes.
Wow.
A soul is like an amorphous scintillating light that's tended by something like bees, and those bees appear to be, I don't know what they are, actually. They might be angels, but it seems it's like a scintillating body of light, and it's different for different people.
I think he'd be quite fascinated if you read some of the later works of Castaneda. He goes into great detail in describing what the energy body or the luminous cocoon, as he describes it, that surrounds each living thing. And it's very interesting. You might be interested.
Okay, then I'll pick it up based on your recommendation.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, sir. East of the Rockies, good morning. You're on the air with Major Ed Dames.
Hi. I got a question for Ed. Hi, Art. My name is Mike from Boca Raton, Florida. I'm sorry.
Hi, Mike.
Are you guys familiar with the West Memphis 3 at all?
No, I guess we're not.
Okay. There were three young men in Memphis, Tennessee that were arrested for three murders of three 7 or 8 year old boys, and they had a documentary on HBO about it about 4 years ago, and they redid a documentary this month, and there was so many holes in the evidence that, you know, it just looked, you know, that, I mean, I don't know how these guys got convicted, and there's all kinds of websites and everything out there for them. And I was wondering if, you know, if Ed was at all familiar with it, would he ever consider remote viewing that incident to see if those guys really did do it?
It would serve no useful purpose, because law enforcement sometimes when they have, but law enforcement has agendas. A good example is, I mean, our company busted our facts on the JonBenet Ramsey murder.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that a photographer did it. It was a photographer that gained entry to that house.
Mm-hmm.
And we attempted to track the photographer's present position and describe it. We passed that information to every DA that was connected with it, all the police departments, the FBI, the father. And unless we have cooperative law enforcement agencies at every level, you know, I'm not going to get involved. It's beating your head against the wall.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Yeah, Art.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised you didn't ask this question yourself, but it must have slipped by you. Back when they arrested the Unabomber.
Yes.
Mr. Dames said that that they tried remote viewing it and that they couldn't target on one person because there seemed to be other people involved.
Two others.
And then afterwards, later, they came out and said that he was involved in some mind control stuff at Berkeley, I believe.
That's right.
And I wondered if maybe that was why.
No. You can't influence a remote viewer using mind control. And you can't, there's nothing that you can do to interfere, with some exceptions, to a remote viewer when they're remote viewing. So,
right.
The Unabomber was responsible for about two-thirds of those bomb attacks. There were two other individuals that were responsible for the others that were grouped in with the Unabombers, Kaczynski's so-called attacks. And I think I've talked about those other two individuals before.
Okay. All right, thank you. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah, this is Andy from Bodega, California.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a question concerning, like, excuse me, a little nervous. What the question is that are there certain personality type of people that do this remote viewing better, or is it pretty much anyone that wants to learn the technique?
Good question. All right, Ed.
It's a two-part answer. They're naturals. People have natural ability. If they learn the very rigorous structure well, they do exceedingly well. They can produce in this way. They produce about twice as much material, descriptive information about a target in a given amount of time as someone like me, for instance, who is not naturally psychic, but just very good in terms of the skill. But if they don't rein in their ego, or if they start bending the rules, bending the rigor, then they can slide back into the 60%, from the 90 to the 60 percentile in terms of accuracy of information. So the rigor has to be there, and if you're naturally talented, that's good too.
All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's Missing Learjet Tim from Cold Lake, Alberta. How you doing?
Just fine, sir.
Hey, Ed, quick question here. We're just about at the top of the hour.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice.
Good to talk to you. I was talking to Ingo Swann, where actually it was the questions and answers after he was on last night, and it's raining calves and cows. What's your take on that?
What?
Running, all these cattle mutilations are falling out of the skies or landing in trees.
Oh, thank you very much for that. Ed, there is
sampling. There's what Ingo called the others.
Yes.
The others responsible for machinery and structures on the moon.
He said them.
Yeah. Those are sampling missions. These are not U.S. government or anything else like that, black helicopters. These are actual, let's call them UFOs for lack of a better word. And this is a very complex technical problem that I don't have time to go into on the show. I've talked to Linda Howe about it, you know, in person. And these are sampling missions. They go through time. They investigate the extent of damage, radiation, and pesticide damage on humankind. It would be better to take human females. But, of course, that would be homicide. And so they take the next best thing. They take the animals that provide milk to our human babies, and they test them, and it's an environmental sampling program.
That's been my best guess as
well.
Yeah,
but these are not U.S. These are not global governments that are doing it.
Gotcha.
Somebody else.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning. Hello. Oh, no, wait a minute. I didn't push the button. Now you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. It's Smoker Nave and Mesa again.
Yes.
I got two questions for you and Ed Dames.
Yes, what are they?
First, for Ed Dames, I wonder what he envisions in the future for the Phoenix, Arizona area. And the second question is, Art, when you get your legal troubles and everything settled...
No, sir, I'm not taking any questions about that. I appreciate that, but I ask you not to do that.
I have no information on the Phoenix area in the future.
Phoenix,
future of the Phoenix area.
Phoenix, no doubt, will be affected as the rest of the globe would, wouldn't it?
I do not, as a professional in my trade, I don't have any biases at all. We go into problem sets clean, absolutely unbiased when we explore something. We don't assume anything.
All right. Listen, Ed, I want to give you a chance here toward the end to hit your tapes again. This time you give out the numbers.
Okay.
If you would. The entire set of videotapes, whether you want one at $49.95, I think, or the entire set, which is $70 off right now, are available by calling the following numbers. Edward?
Okay. 1-888-878-0333 or 1-877-878-1777. Live operators, and we can also be visited on the World Wide Web at scitech.net, and that's P-S-I-T-E-C-H. If you want to get some background on what you're getting into, it's all there on the World Wide Web.
Well, Ed, I don't know what to say. You know, it's been a lot of years.
It's been more than 3.5, and I guess, as my wife is wont to say, passing on to you are all good things. We'll be in touch.
Indeed, we'll be in touch. And should anything prior to my final show, April 26th, come up that really you want to get on the air, you know that I'm here for you.
And vice versa.
And if we don't do it on the air again, we've done some damn good stuff over the time, Ed. So what can I say except thank you?
Oh, the pleasure has been mine, and I'm honored to have been your guest, Art.
Good night, my friend.
Good night.
That's it, folks. That's Major Ed Dames. SciTech's Major Ed Dames. Now, the announcement that I made earlier is going to be repeated in the next hour for those radio stations that have it. Otherwise, it's available on the web, on my website at www.artbell.com, both the audio form and the written version. And also, I might add, you can get to that very same website by entering www.coasttocoastam. Its real future name. So you might give that a try, actually. www.coasttocoastam.com. And I think you'll find it'll zip you right into a very new-looking website. So for this night and this guy, that's it. See you next Tuesday from the high desert where the winds finally have abated a bit. Good night, all.
AM 840, KXNT. Although